The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Rich Wagner, the CEO at Cash Plus. I was actually looking at your profile before and noticed you kind of went to USC. It's a great place. I actually lived out in California for a few years myself. Very fond memories of that place. I've been to USC's campus a couple of times, actually. It's quite the place.
Yeah, well, the neighborhood is actually not as not that good, but certainly the university and certainly my education there, I was very proud to be able to go there. I'm still a fighting Trojan to this day, and I've been fortunate enough to have some of my friends, relatives, godchildren actually go there also. So it's a great school. A lot of different schools within the university that are top grade, and I enjoyed Los Angeles. As you know, I'm a California kid, born and raised in San Francisco, and my choices were limited because I wanted to go to university in California.
Right.
There was no other state that I wanted to be in, so it was great.
Yeah, it's not a bad choice, and I can imagine some of those games, especially between UCLA, being particularly feisty, but nonetheless very, very entertaining.
Yes, very much so. Collegiate sports is a big thing in the U.S. I think most of my U.K. colleagues can't believe, a college game can pack in 100,000 people, but we do.
Yeah, I know. It's insane. I would like to say when I went out there, that was a bit of a shock to me as well. It's like I'm a big Man U fan, so seeing that the local college teams get more attendees than one of the biggest and wealthiest clubs in the world was a shock to the system.
Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah. Well, it's great to have you on the show. Rich, it's again, as I said before we started recording, it's always appreciate anyone kind of willing to give me the time to chat. I really enjoy doing these. So first of all, thank you so much for taking the time.
No problem. Look forward to it.
I find it really fascinating, kind of the space that you're in at the moment, and obviously Cash Plus, and just the whole, I suppose, like finance fintech space at the minute. It seems as though it's kind of grown a life of its own, or at least I've noticed it in very recent years. You before you kind of got involved with Cash Plus, obviously worked for some larger organizations within banking, and I've got to be honest, until I started to become an adult, I don't think I ever took banking and finance seriously as like I do now. And I think that's probably the same story for a lot of people. But I think it probably gets a bad rap in some ways because it can be such an enabler, if it's done right. Subsequently, it's something that I've always kept a keen eye on because I felt relatively passionate about it. That the ability that, banking done well can give people, it really can be empowering. So I can see that it's obvious to me that you can have a real strong passion about it, but maybe not as obvious to other people. Perhaps within your kind of world, though, there is a lot of people who are passionate about it, and probably including that is yourself.
Oh, well, absolutely. Payments is a fascinating industry, especially when you get under it. And I think you could probably and you think about all the innovation that has come, and a lot of people see payments as something that gets in the way of then buying something that they want. Mm. And our job in the payments industry, we talk about it. How do we take payments out of payments? And the reason I say that is the best example that I've seen most recently, and I know it's Uber.
Right.
Think about Uber. Uber has been a fantastic success story globally. And, people talk about it as being a transportation company. What it is, though, it really is a logistics and payments company. because what you're doing is making it easy for somebody to connect with somebody else, and most importantly, the ability to pay the Uber driver is almost irrelevant in the entire transaction that occurs. You're brought from point A to point B, and that's it. Somebody pays and gets paid, but that's irrelevant in the whole experience and the journey that you have. And for the last 30 years, certainly from my perspective, getting to that utopia of taking payments out of payment, and what we do in our own Cash Plus organization is exactly that. Make it simple, easy, straightforward for people to get the product, use the product, and take the complexity of banking and the mystery of banking away, so young people get excited about getting a banking product rather than thinking it's something that they have to do. Mm. It's something that they want to do.
Yeah. No, I think so. I think there's a lot of kind of, like with most things, seems to me as though there's been a lack of transparency for years, right, around the space. And I think what a lot of the fintech movement and, you know, the payment space and obviously I'm sure what Cash Plus have focused on is to kind of break down those barriers and just try and be more transparent and, you know, allow the kind of the average person to understand what the heck's going on. You know, I think the banking space seems to have always been very good at coming up with very complicated terms for things, so the kind of the layman's like me have no idea what's going on. And I think there seems to be, you know, a real sense of trying to break down those barriers and enabling people to, you know, just understand exactly what's going on here.
Yes, and making it simple for everyone, the common individual, to know. And we service, you know, consumers. We service over 100,000 small businesses in the UK, and most of them, you know, unlike, you know, myself or some of the colleagues I work with in the industry, they're not payments experts, they're not banking experts, nor do I think that they should be. And mm-hmm. you know, we take things like the terms and conditions for a business bank account. If you go to one of the high street banks, you know, the terms and conditions can be upwards to 20 to 25 pages. You know, ours is probably less than two. It fits on both sides of an A4 piece of paper. The pricing, they charge maybe 20 to 30 different fees. They're relatively small, but, you know, you never know when you're going to get caught out. Mm. You know, our fee structure, you know, kind of have a model that, you know, no more than five different types of charges that can actually occur on account, and make them, and if you can get it down to one charge, then great. But, you know, I think making it really simple to use, simple to pay for, simple to understand what you're getting and the value you're getting for it, and making it common sensible for people to get on board the fintech revolution with new and cool things that I'm sure we'll talk about, is the primary goal for Cash Plus.
Right. Absolutely. You know, we talk a lot about kind of technology on this show. We talk a lot about leadership. You know, we talk a lot about people, really. You know, I think all what's happened within tech, you made the example of what Uber is. It's like people kind of got it wrong. It's actually a logistics and payments business, right? I think that kind of banking is becoming that way as well. Like, and it's leveraging technology as an enabler. So do you think that some of the things that we're able to do now with modern banking, you know, has it just been a case of a waiting game for technology so that we can actually leverage it to work on some of, like as you mentioned, some of the more efficient and kind of cooler things that we're able to do now?
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, you got to remember, I started work and I came out of USC and I went into a job where there wasn't a computer on the desk. Think about that. There wasn't even a computer on the desk. We had to go to a shared PC area. That shows you how old I am. But it's the revolution of technology has made things faster and easier for everyone. You think about the whole Apple user interface. You look at Windows. Even that has come a long way to make it easy for the common person to be able to use technology. And I go back to my father-in-law, 83 years old. He Skypes my wife everything every single day. You know, it's for him, you know, to be able to start learning computers when he was probably about 75 and now, you know, using computers quite frequently, you know, he was a, you know, a blue collar worker now, you know, using technology that enriches his life, the ability to talk to his daughter every day, 7,000 miles away from each other, and visually, not just in an audio way, like typical phones, be able to have an engagement that you never saw, you know, even 10 years ago. Let's not forget, I always like to talk about how, you know, it was only 10 years ago, 11 years now, that the iPhone was created. Right. But just the evolution of that technology and Samsung collectively together to create that smartphone that now allows you to take, I call it banking in a box or banking in your phone. And you talk about mobile banking and things of that sort. But that evolution of allowing accessibility to your banking product and allowing other technology companies to start integrating with that boring bank account, that boring current account that you have, and enriching the data to allow budgeting, transaction monitoring, and more frequent engagement with your bank on cool things like discounts to Costa Coffee or to Starbucks, or, you know, get the next good deal on Amazon.com. You know, those types of things, I think, really enable a dare I say it, a funner experience with your bank than you ever had 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think you see that in a lot of service-based industries now, you know, and I do think technology has been the enabler, and specifically the transparency in these kind of service-based industries. It's, you know, a lot of service-based industries, I suppose, were historically like kind of a necessary evil, right? You could probably even include like bank accounts and things like that within that. You know, and like you're saying, it's moving away from that now. Like, I almost don't think that, you know, if there is price points associated, is that important anymore? I don't think that it is as compelling. I think it's about the experience, and that is what I think customers are craving now, much more so. Yeah. I don't even think price is that important, and that's my opinion at least.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. And I think when people go out there, you have to make sure. Yeah, you know, we talk about price in our company quite a bit. And we've been a company that's been in fintech, and fintech has gotten a great name in the industry as a cool place to work, a cool place to grow with a company. But you also have to realize that in these new emerging areas, you also have to make sure that you do make money. And the key thing is, cool things, sometimes they first come out and they're free. They want to get early adoption. But I think for more mature fintechs like ourselves, there's a relationship between the customer, the company, and the shareholder of the company that needs to align to the point that if I'm giving you good value, I'm going to charge for it. And you should be appreciative of that. And if we're not delivering on our promise from Cash Plus and we're charging you for that service and we're not delivering on it, then, you know, you have the right to leave. And the ability to leave, it becomes a little bit easier. But by giving them something that they actually have to pay for, puts them in a point of gratitude and affiliation that, hey, I like Cash Plus so much, I'm willing to pay for their product, is so important. And what makes that important is that in the end game, I'm actually getting a return on investment off of that product and giving that back to my shareholder, who then wants to reinvest in the business. And when you're profitable, employees get to see that as a huge benefit. I don't have to worry whether or not this company is going to be around or not. So you get to really be involved with a really cool, innovative fintech. But for Cash Plus, well, our differentiator is we've been around for 13 years. We've been profitable for 7 years. And it allows employees who work for us and those candidates who want to work for us in the future the ability to have the best of both, the excitement of working for somebody like Cash Plus in the fintech cool arena, but recognizing that we've been around for 13 years, we're going to be around for the next couple decades, that security is a great balance that I think is a great differentiator for us as we go out and recruit. And, you know, we are doing quite a bit of recruiting now with, you know, literally about 40 to 50 roles that are currently being currently worked on. And, you know, we put a press release out that our banking license will require upwards to 400 new employees within Cash Blast in the next 3 to 5 years.
Wow. That must feel like a bit of an overwhelming task at this point. I think I'd have a bit of a mini meltdown at that if I was told that.
Well, yeah, I think it's growth creates excitement, passion, and wanting to do something different. We have a purpose in our company. We call it, proving it's possible. We were the first to do so many things and prove that you don't necessarily need to be a bank to bank. We set up the first current account without a banking license. We set up the first credit facility without a banking license using regulatory environments that allowed us to do it legally, properly, transparently, and in a way that actually ingratiated the customers. But these were things that were never thought of, you know, back in the 1990s, 2000, when we started in 2005. This was really unheard of. Mm. You know, if you wanted a bank account, you had the choice of 4 clearing banks in the UK. That was it. You know, you had a couple building societies, but your choices were quite limited. And I think today, the millennials, the younger people getting into banking have so many more choices to take now. Puts pressure on Cash Plus to deliver the best of the best so they choose us over others. But at the end consumer game, I think consumers like yourself are in a great position and something that I haven't seen in 30 years. The choice you have and the value-added services that you get out of banking is phenomenal. It's not boring banking anymore. It's cool payments that really are driving fintech, certainly in the UK.
It must have been difficult. I mean, obviously, I wasn't actively involved, and nor do I claim to have any idea. But, you know, like you were saying, in 2005, when there was very limited options, to try and kind of break down those barriers and be the kind of the disruptor, I can't imagine like how much of a monumental task that would have been at that time. You probably witnessed it from a different perspective. But you know, what were some of the kind of requirements and the necessities that were involved in that kind of process at that time?
Well, I think it started, you know, with my personal experience, and I've shared this story quite a bit at industry conferences, which people kind of roll their eyes. I mean, again, here I am, an American. I came to the UK prior to setting up Cash Plus back in '99 with a bank from the US. I came, you know, got a company apartment. I was an expat. And working as an expat within a work environment. So I didn't have a phone bill. I didn't have an electricity bill. I didn't have the things that you needed to set up a bank account.
Right.
And I was getting, you know, I got paid very well. I got paid in US dollars. But it took me 6 months to get a UK bank account. And here, you know, hey, I would consider myself probably above average in terms of ability and knowledge about the banking industry, the distribution of banking, how to get a bank account, and all these things. And even I took 6 months 20 years ago to get a bank account. And that friction was something that really spearheaded the idea of kind of breaking down these barriers. There's got to be a simpler way to do this stuff. And that's really started the whole thing. And so, you know, the barriers that we got, even setting up our business bank account with our high street lender was just quite farcical. I went into the branch, literally sat down with a personal banker. I will say the personal banker was quite friendly, but I sat down and I was there for 4 hours filling out paperwork. Right. And again, I'm thinking, my goodness, this whole system of paper pushing and, you know, archaic operational processes need a better solution. And, you know, the nice thing about starting, and I think the challenges that all the big banks have, and they talk about the legacy systems, the mainframes that very few people know anything about these days, you know, our current account structure sits on these very old legacy, slow systems. They're relatively stable, but they're just slow. Mm. But I thought, well, it requires paper. And so it's like, well, first of all, let's get rid of the paper. You know, there's no reason in signing up for a bank account in the 21st century, you should have any paper involved in the process.
Right.
Do I need to really even, you know, most people, I mean, I'm one of these people, even if I'm showing my age, I really do not like calling a call center. Typically, if I got to call a call center, it's going to be a bad outcome for me. I'm going to be frustrated. I'm going to be stressed. So if I can not have you need to call me because I make it so simple for you, then we all win. As a customer, they don't really want to call. It's going to waste their time. And for us, we don't even want to take the call because it costs us money to put, you know, a customer service advisor on the phone to take that call. So if I can take those calls and take that friction out of setting up an account, we thought that we could really win. And, you know, we did. We literally took what, you know, took me 6 months, but on average back in 2005, it probably took anywhere between 3 to 5 days on a good journey, upwards to 2 weeks to a month on a bad journey to get a bank account. And we took that on the head and literally started booking accounts within 3 minutes, you know, and that really revolutionized, and it not only ingratiated the customer going, wow, this is fast, this is cool, this is fantastic, but it also cut out a lot of costs on our side that we were able to pass on that value into a much cheaper bank account to those end users, which, you know, again, everybody won.
Yeah, it's it sounds so simple, doesn't it, now? I suppose I can't really, you know, as, like I say, I just can't even perceive having to go through all that paperwork. I can't even remember ever writing a check, I'll be honest. So never mind like going down to a bank, having an actual meeting, you know, writing out that paperwork. It kind of seems overwhelming now. Like you say, relatively speaking, it wasn't that long ago, which is the scary thing about it. It's just that now, like you're saying, time flies so fast and innovations are kind of always daunting on us that that seems like, you know, just seems like so long ago. But wow, yeah, I mean, what a difference though in experience, you know, for the consumer now, and probably something that everyone will probably already be taking for granted, I would assume.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and the world continues to change. I mean, I don't think I ever thought of a day where I wouldn't have a piece of plastic in my wallet. I mean, I grew up, you know, in California, the birthplace of Visa, and the birthplace of the kind of the credit and debit type plastic. And you know, I'm looking at today, and I can tell you most of my colleagues and workers who are certainly a lot younger than I am, they're more than happy to forget their wallet at home. They won't forget their mobile phone though. And the fact that you can now connect with people through social media using a phone, you can actually phone people using a phone, which I know is kind of ironic, but you know, today you can pay people using your mobile phone. So your wallet has, in the last 30 years, your wallet has become obsolete. The payment tokens, those plastics that sit in your wallet today, have become obsolete through the mobile payment technology that's out there, and you know, the whole way you pay has really transformed to allow people to use a single device, a mobile or even a card, and not even have to worry about PIN numbers or signatures or things of that sort. You literally take your card out, and in my case, sometimes I even keep it in my wallet. Tap my wallet, you know, on the underground, and bang, you know, I'm in the underground.
Yeah.
By using a device that I've not even taken out of my wallet.
Yeah.
Which I think that technology of contactless and mobile has really transformed the way we think and the way we pay these days, and that will transform even further into the future.
And now, you know, with that being said, you talk about the growth necessary for you guys in the coming years. I bet you couldn't have imagined either, you know, in, you know, 99 or prior to that, that I'm sure, you know, the vast majority of the new hires are going to be kind of technology orientated. I bet they had like a tiny back office team, didn't they, in the 90s?
Yeah. Well, I think the funny thing is, because you had such a manual process going to technology, right now, the good news, most of the 400 people that we will be hiring is certainly the front office, in terms of talking to clients, talking to customers, you know, when we need to. Back office operations have been extremely automated. I remember 20 years ago, I had probably maybe 100 times more back office staff than I do now, for the same size portfolio, which on it's transformational. I think the key thing is, though, is that, and I think it's a good thing, is we've taken out some of the many of the low-skilled transactional activity of running a bank, which is great. The bad news is now I need really much more qualified staff to handle more complex transactions because I have automated through, you know, AI and automatic decisions and automatic workflow processes, where those easy processes are now no longer handled by a human being. Now I need very well-educated, you know, banking professionals handling the transactions for our businesses and our consumers. So the transformation of the types of employees I need now, technology has benefited it's on one side, allowing it easier for customers. It's also given a lot of career opportunities to the people coming out of university, where the entry-level job these days is far more, you know, integrated with your education as opposed to a transactional job, which I think is also exciting.
Well, I think that's the most exciting thing about automation technologies, you know, AI and such, right, is that I think the next generation are going to be very much empowered to leverage, you know, their full kind of ability and capacity to learn much more so than in prior generations, because, like you say, a lot of the kind of the manual kind of work is going to be eliminated. And I'm actually one person who thinks that's massively positive and isn't necessarily worried about that, because I think it gives us the time, it gives us the perspective, and it gives us the ability to spend the time on really using, you know, our ability as humans, which is, you know, to constantly push ourselves, you know, to a mental capacity and to innovate. So I think, you know, banking is the prime example. But I think across the board, it's a compelling time. And I look forward to the next few years, because I do think that this is going to be the case. Like you were saying, the entry-level people, you know, what they're going to be able to get involved in from an early stage is going to be phenomenal, because, you know, it's counterintuitive now to have people doing, you know, kind of mundane, you know, manual roles these days.
Yeah, no, and I find it still. I mean, I wish I could get reincarnated as a student again, because I've got a couple of friends of mine where their kids are in, you know, school. They're, you know, anywhere between 10 and 15 years old, and they're developing apps.
Right.
They're developing, you know, I went to school and I was, you know, on a chalkboard, you know, adding up a column of 3 + 5 + 10. And now I've got 10-year-olds that are, you know, creating very simple apps, you know, a checkers game or a map or anything like that. But they're creating these things such at 10 years old, where, you know, by the time that they get fully educated through the UK system, they really are going to be really contributing members of society, making the lives of all of us, you know, tremendously better. And I look forward to the day that I retire, because all this new generation, second and third generation that will come into this industry, really are going to have a leg up on education. Although I would say, I think the UK needs to continue to invest in education and put money behind the efforts to make and continue to keep the UK the fintech capital of the world. But regardless, I think it's a great time to be a student. I think in university systems today, because there's, and even in lower educational areas, because the technology is really allowing them to do far greater things than I was ever able to do 40 years ago when I was going to school.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head for me as well. I feel quite passionately about that, that there needs to be a constant investment in traditional educational capacities. You know, people are able to pick up the skills, you know, the technical people we have on the show, lots of them learn things outside of these kind of traditional realms. But I do think that there's still a lot of kind of problem solving skills and such that you can learn in the traditional setting that I think are kind of invaluable when you do get into the working world. But you know, it's going to be less desirable, especially the, you know, the way that kind of a degree is being essentially devalued, but yet the price seems to be going up. The economics don't make sense, and I think eventually people are going to cotton on to that, you know, and diverge away from that kind of traditional path, which I think is, it would be such a shame, because I do think that there are a lot of skills, you know, I suppose you'd call them like the softer skills and maybe problem solving skills, that I think you do learn and can be tremendously beneficial in the working life.
Yeah, and I think having that diversity of kind of logic, problem solving skills is so important. And to be fair, I think people, you know, out there as they're going through the university systems, I can only share my experience. I mean, I went to university in America and, you know, started my career in engineering and technology. In fact, I was I got close to getting a degree in computer science. So not surprisingly, I'm in technology. But I'll admit to you and to your listeners, I was terrible at computer science. I couldn't. I was not as good as my colleagues, and I could see that. But by taking those courses gave me the ability to sequentially and logically go through a problem-solving exercise. And although I don't, you know, I don't program, you know, today, you know, even in my CEO role, I have an ability, or hopefully ability, to help people solve problems by logically going through the options and coming to a successful conclusion. And that wasn't the result of going to business school. That was a result of probably taking a computer science class, where I learned some very tactical level steps in terms of getting to an end solution that I took and used in my management and my executive management in a day-to-day way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're such different skill sets, aren't they? You know, and I'm sure that, you know, beyond that, you've had tremendous influences and experiences. I think people are always fascinated about CEOs and how, I suppose, that you've got to becoming a CEO. I think people are particularly fascinated because there's not always, I suppose, like a traditional path to becoming a CEO. You know, what do you think, out of the things that you feel were your strengths and you believe were sort of those consistent characteristics that you possessed that allowed you to kind of, you know, ascend to becoming, you know, the most senior role in an organization?
Yeah, I think, well, one, if you actually set up the company, you get to be CEO. So that actually helps quite a bit. So probably the tenacity of, founding a company does take, you know, and being an entrepreneur in a very small company that allows you to have a greater chance of becoming the leader of that organization is certainly a skill set that people talk about. Ooh, it would be great to be an entrepreneur. Ooh, it'd be great to be a founder. And I tell people, yeah, but don't, you know, recognize the result of that. If you, you know, talk to Olympians and stuff like that, and, you know, everything takes hard work. Success, you know, it takes a, you know, there's a comment made about our 13-year history and our success and stuff. You know, it takes a very long time to have an overnight success. And I, you know, nothing is an overnight success. Overnight successes come from many hours, many years potentially, of sticking to a interest, a passion, whatever you call it, and driving toward that success. And then one day, you know, that success will be seen by others. And I think for me, I think, you know, that persistency and hard work, I hope, you know, showed through to the point that, you know, I got many no's, many rejections. You're not going to be able to do this. Oh, no, banking is never going to change. And, you know, all these negatives that are put in front of you. And I think you need the persistency, the desire and the passion to do something and have an interest in it that allows you to kind of push through those negative times, those negative moments, to a point that you finally do break through and prove to someone that, ooh, maybe that idea is pretty cool. Ooh, maybe this guy does know what he's talking about. And I say that for both men and women, that, you know, it's, you know, I don't like using the American term follow your dreams, because dreams don't come through either without hard work. Sometimes it's just the basic hard work, interest, and passion that will really drive success and get you to a point of CEO. Do I really want to be a CEO? And to be fair, that wasn't my end game. My end game was proving new ways to pay and be paid was what really got me out of bed every morning. It just happened to be that the way I could do that is to found a company. And by founding the company, I ended up accidentally, and because I founded it, I had to be the CEO. But my passion is actually solving problems and delivering payment solutions and creating innovation in payments and fintech. That's what I get out of bed for. I'm not really into the power trip of a CEO position.
Yeah.
And I think you have to really take that on board.
Well, but I like that even if you didn't found the company and you kind of ascended to it in a big organization. So why that attitude should be consistent. It shouldn't be, a power trip, I suppose. So I think even though, you know, you obviously founded the company, I think those lessons are still need to be consistent for any kind of senior people. I like it a lot, you know, at least the attitude side of it.
Yeah, and I think to be CEO, though, you have to have a strong foundation of education and experience. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. I mean, so I didn't become a CEO overnight. I worked my way up in big companies, as you saw in my profile, probably on LinkedIn. I learned the craft, and I got excited by the craft, and I guess I was able to prove to my managers that the passion that I had could allow me to transfer into other areas of the business and provide value. And so, you know, I kind of graduated with a, you know, business kind of business analysis type background. And I remember that my manager coming to me one day and saying, we need you in marketing for a couple months. I said, no, my CV, I don't have any marketing career. No. You've got the attitude that will make you good at what we need you to get done in marketing. I don't care necessarily now that of whatever your educational background. And I think people, when they are able to show their initiative, show their ability to work outside their comfort zone and learn while they're on the job and take those skills and continue to develop those skills over many years within your career, whatever organization, big or small, I think that's the real success factor for any candidates or individuals going into any job these days.
If you were to, and I'm conscious of time as well, Rich, so I won't keep you too much longer, but if, if you were to ever give, I suppose, advice to a younger version of yourself, maybe just graduating straight out of USC, would there be any kind of wise words maybe that you've, that you feel as though, or wisdom that you've acquired since then?
Boy, the world's moved on since I graduated from USC. So I think the world's created a different mindset. I mean, when my dad went to work, it was a job for life. He worked at a particular company for 40 years. My wife's dad, you know, worked at Ford Motor Company for 40 years. You know, that doesn't happen any longer, and that's okay. But it was actually seen as something really bad if you didn't work for a company for your entire life. I think my life experience is that I was lucky enough to start in a company that was growing very fast. They were already making money, which was actually very good. So I always think that you should go into something that's exciting. But also, I've seen so many, you know, we talked about the excitement of fintech, but let's not forget, in my 13 years in fintech, specifically in the UK, and the 20 years that I've been in banking in the UK, there's been a lot of successes, but there's also been a lot of failures. Mm. So in your careers, you want to try to align yourself with successful companies, because you can be a success. It's very easy to be successful in a successful company. It's very difficult to be successful in a not so successful company. So no matter how good you are, try to you really have to look to the winning companies as opposed to the potential winning companies when you're selecting for that cool role within fintech. And you know that would be my advice. Continue to strive toward finding those winning combinations that give you the candidate, the new employee, the breadth of experience that you're looking for, but also that company that can nurture you and allow you to be successful within an already successful environment.
I like it. And finally, you know, do you get time to kind of enjoy what you've kind of achieved to this point, or are you one of these people who you're constantly striving? Maybe you've had perspective during this podcast, but...
Yeah, I have a hobby? My hobby is cooking, so I love cooking. But I certainly there will be one day that I retire. But even when I retire, which is still years away, I will always want to give back to the payments industry. So I will work with within incubator groups. I'll work with young CEOs that are half my age by the time I retire, but people that can maybe leverage my experience and I can give back. To the industry, what I've gotten out of it over the last 30 years. So for me, my hobby is payments. Hate to say it. My hobby is this fintech revolution that we're in, and I will always have a little piece in it, no matter how old I get or how retired I get. I will always be affectionately affiliated with this particular industry that's been cool 10 years ago, continues to be cool today, and my belief it's going to be cool for the next 20 to 50 years.
Rich, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time today and having a nice chat with me. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.